Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to Squeaky and the Peeps. I'm turning this over to you. It's your big chance, Rabideau. I have laryngitis.
Yeah, I'm going to be the star of the show for just at least the next 59 minutes. So welcome, everybody. It's nice to have you with us at this first show in the year of our Lord, 2013. We wish you, of course, a happy and prosperous new year. And we're glad the fiscal cliff has been avoided so far and all that kind of good stuff.
And who are we? We're on the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig.
We are, and we were in another country over the Christmas holiday, and we certainly got a lot of questions about what was going on here. But most importantly, we were hunting for some dining pleasures that we could recommend to you, in addition to enjoying some time with Peter's brother and family. In West Cornwall, in the southwest of England,
where it was all cooks.
Where it was raining.
Yeah, your brother, our three nephews, all cook.
Yeah, and I didn't get to cook at all, which was really good fun. But we did have some wonderful people cooking for us. And curiously, the first place we're going to visit today, which is a restaurant called Casa Mia.
Loved it.
Has the distinction of having the only Michelin star in Bristol, which is one of the big cities in England, and basically a gateway to the western part of the country, southwest part of the country. So we stopped there, and we had the opportunity to meet the owners, who are brothers, John Ray and Peter Sanchez Iglesias. You're guessing they're not originally English. And their father, who provides the name, is actually from Spain. But he opened an Italian restaurant, and then there's a long story about what happened. So here it is.
Well, we're in a restaurant called Casa Mia, and we're looking forward to having a fabulous meal, according to all accounts. We wanted to start at the basics to find out what kind of a restaurant it was. And from the name, My House, I assumed that it was Italian or Spanish. And since the owners are Sanchez Iglesias, I assume Spanish. But now, John Ray, one of the brothers who are chefing and running this establishment, says, no, it's Italian. Now, that is the story, John Ray. Tell us.
Oh, thank you. So, the story starts really with mine and Peter's parents. They opened this place in 1999. And Dad, being Spanish, when he moved to England originally, he worked with a lot of Italian people and a lot of Italian restaurants. And so, he felt that whilst he was working through the restaurants, he gained quite a lot of experience and really loved the culture and the cuisine that they had to offer. So when the opportunity came to buy this place in 99, it would only make sense to open it as a trattoria, very classic pizza pasta restaurant, inspired by his early days working with fellow Italians. So it made sense financially, because back then tapas bars were not well heard of. So him and Mum opened it, and we came from a background that wasn't poor, but it was we didn't have loads of money when we were growing up. And Dad and Mum worked really, really hard. So when they had the opportunity to open this place, it changed our lives dramatically. From day one, it was very, very busy. There was people queuing to come in. There wasn't that many Italian restaurants here in Bristol, so a really good success rate in working. But at the same time, Mum and Dad put so much into the business to make it work. It's quite an inspiring story, really. So everybody kind of was a bit nervous, I think, family-wise, when they opened it. And like I said, the queue and the people coming in just created this amazing, busy Italian restaurant. So me and Pete were amazed and thought it was fantastic. And all of a sudden, went from not having much money to being able to buy more when we went shopping, be able to buy some better clothes. Got to the point where Dad bought me a car when I first started driving. Things like that, you know, wasn't going to ever be possible before we moved here. So it was amazing. It changed our whole lifestyle. And meanwhile, me and Peter were still at school. We weren't doing that well. We both really didn't feel academically we worked that well at school. And I left before him, obviously being 2 years older. I had the how old? At the time I was, my age now is, I'm 29. Just turned 29 and Peter's 27. And back then we were 17, 18. And I left school with no qualifications. And I went off and did an art and design course. I moved on to graphic design. And at that time when I left, and I was a few months into my graphic design course, Peter left school with no qualifications, probably trying to follow in my footsteps, and had the opportunity to do a catering college course. So whilst he was doing that and I was finishing my graphic design course, we were also both working part about time here. And we both started off in the bar, and eventually Peter made his way into the kitchen, and I used to help wash up and also wash up in the bar or help my dad front of house. And as I got to the end of my college course myself, Peter just started to break right through into the kitchen. And what happened was, one night a really, really great chef and still a friend today decided to walk out in the middle of service, and he left all the checks to Pete. And Peter was looking at it going, oh my god, what do I do? And he managed to get through it, and I don't know how, because it was god knows how many steaks and chickens in the ovens and all sorts. You can imagine it was something out of Gordon Ramsay's kitchen nightmare. And he really, really did an amazing job. He was only just, I think, sort of just past 16 years old, and he'd done an incredible job and managed to get himself out of it. Showed a remarkable skills as a chef, and my dad noticed it and went, right, give him the opportunity to continue running the kitchen whilst he was finishing his college course, which was amazing. 16 to be a head chef of a restaurant's pretty phenomenal. And then at the time we had a couple of people helping Pete, but they weren't very, very supportive in the kitchen and a little bit lacking experience. He used to ask me to come and help him now and again, so I used to come in and he used to teach me basics, stocks, meat preparation, preparation of herbs, and I just decided, wow, I love this. And Pete obviously realised that and asked me what I was thinking about doing once I left my college course. And I just said, well, I'm not too sure, I wasn't very happy with it. So he asked me to help him in the kitchen, which was at the time an amazing thing. And so I took the opportunity up. So we started our little journey together, and he told me all the basics. I wanted to go to college, and Pete said, no, I'm going to show you everything. I've already seen everything that's going on. I'll give you a bit of a crash course. And that was the start of me and him working together.
But you make it sound like it just rolled along smoothly. You came on board, and you had endless criticisms of how this restaurant was run. And what were your big objections, and what were some of the things you discovered that you felt compelled to correct, and what did you do?
Well, as we sort of had the chance to work together so closely, I started to ask Pete questions, and I think then he started to question things, and it was just stupid things like, how can we use tinned artichokes, or why are we throwing so much away? Like, is there another way of doing it? And Pete really sort of looked at me, I guess, is probably, yeah, I don't know why, that's a good point. And so he started questioning loads of stuff himself then, and we kind of went on this little mission to really, really transform what we were doing. And so we started to shorten the menu, and with that, it meant that we had a few family debates. My dad wasn't too happy because obviously he had a reasonably successful restaurant at the time, still doing really well. But me and Pete weren't happy, you know. We said, look, we don't believe in throwing away so much fish, so much meat, and also we really want to give people much more fresher produce. So we had a little bit of a fallout, which was a shame. And I think me and Pete, being very young and naive, we decided to go and do our own thing. And this was a year and a half into working, about 2 years working together. So we managed to get a small loan together, and we set up a restaurant in Cheltenham. Yeah, so it was a very, very brave thing to do and a very stupid thing to do. And it probably was defined who we are now, to be honest, because we went there and we had this old, it was an old French bistro, and it was on a one-way system in a nice part of Cheltenham. It's very small. And so we renovated it ourselves, give it a Georgian townhouse feel, and put together a very small, short set Italian menu based on stuff that we'd learnt here and what we'd already sort of challenged ourselves together. So, but this time we were making our own desserts, and we were making our own pasta, and we were making everything from scratch, whereas in the restaurant we were still there were still desserts being produced back of house, and there were still things bought in. But this was really our chance to be able to make fresh things.
But you were building your own audience here. I can jump back and just imagine what the regulars at your Italian restaurant were thinking when you were making really major changes in menus here. Did people abandon you wholesale, or did people find new people find you, or what happened?
It was difficult because once, you know, like I said, once we had the restaurant in Cheltenham, and unfortunately it lasted 2 years, and we had to sell it. Yeah, we had to sell it before we went right under. And we came back, and then we started, yeah, to put those changes together that, like you said, that started to define Casa Mia. And yes, a lot of people walked out. It was a shame, really, because we were producing things like tomato and basil sorbet with octopus carpaccio, and really sort of starting to shape what our definition of Italian food was. We were looking at Michelin star restaurants around Italy and seeing that they were creating dishes that were not normally associated with Italian food. But then for me and Pete, we realized that our food started to evolve, and we really wanted to start to open up and be true to our roots and British guys, you know. There's no doubt about it, with Italian influence because of the people around us and our past. And our father being Spanish, we really thought that we should be looking really at other sources of ideas and stuff. So we did. As we did that, our food started to change a hell of a lot. We really did.
Now, you have to have been having people that you looked up to that were, whether you were personally involved with or not, mentors, inspirational people in England or in Spain. Who were some of your mentors?
Some of our mentors were, I think at the time, Gordon Ramsay was a really, really big one because he was shaping British food. I think he'd taken what Marco Pierre White started and started to evolve it even further. And I think once he won his 3 stars, which wasn't that long after, I guess, this restaurant had opened and stuff, he was the person that a lot of us were looking at up to in British food. Then as the movement of food went on, and I would say probably when me and Pete were in Cheltenham, Heston Blumenthal had won his 3rd star, and everyone was looking at his food, and I think that really changed a lot for us as chefs, especially me and Pete, because we were questioning a lot of things anyway. But then listening to Heston's stories of how he was questioning cooking methods and also just simple basics of baking and all sorts, you know, maybe cooking a green bean, really started to make us even then think it's okay to question, let's keep it going, we're not doing nothing wrong with that. And then Fran Adrià at the background was turning food on its head, and I think which is what inspired Gordon and Heston, really. You know, these guys had already known what Fran was doing, and his whole philosophy of being able to, I don't know, just shape food and looking beyond it, looking beyond the piece of red mullet, looking at the bones and thinking, what can I do with the bones, not the meat? It's quite a strange, unusual thing that a chef could do. So yeah, these people are the ones that really sort of helps us shape what we're doing, I think.
I don't know if we made it clear, but you are very young guys to have a Michelin star. And when did you get that?
The Michelin star came 5 years now we've had it. So, yeah, it's an amazing thing.
So you were really young, my goodness. No, but you did have some star space through Gordon's competition, in Britain, chef's competition. What was his television program?
Yeah, we got approached a few years ago to be a part of a program called Ramsay's Best Restaurant, which was a program designed for Gordon to pick his best favorite restaurant out of quite a wide catch of establishments, you know, from Indian food to all right food, from British to French to Italian. So yeah, it was really good to be a part of that. And we almost didn't do it at the start because we were just starting to transform our food from evolving from being a classic trattoria restaurant, then on to modern Italian, to then moving forward into a more, not British, but like a new movement of British food, I'd say. So it was a difficult challenge to try and do, so.
Do you think, would you associate your style of cuisine here, menu cooking, more with modern British or modern Spanish, or I don't want to say molecular gastronomy because we don't say that anymore, modernist cuisine? Where do you fall in the spectrum?
Well, it's interesting. It's a really, really good question. It's something a lot of us are trying to shape here in the UK. So you've got Nordic cuisine and you've got Spanish cuisine, which now everyone associates with what Fran Adrià has been doing. For us, me and Pete, we define our food as we take inspiration from everything around us, from childhood memories to people we meet, trips we've been on. We come up with ideas that are based on British produce, the best we can get hold of, and that we want people to go on a real journey. And it's almost something from our imagination or from our soul that we really try to bring onto the plate, so that when people are eating it, they're eating a part of us, not just a concept. I would say that's what defines our food at the moment. A lot of people are obviously mistaken by the name Casamia, but we kept the name. We never transformed it because to other names and other restaurants, and Fat Duck, for instance, is such a crazy name that Heston kept it. He never changed it, and he made meaning for the name. So we kept Casamia because our parents have worked so hard to establish that restaurant name, and we've just tried to be brave, really, and push forward. Our food is I guess, it's going to be classed as modern British. I can't think of anything else really to define it. And there's no real category.
Okay, we're having dinner here tonight. I can't jump in on what food is because I haven't tasted it yet, but give us some idea of what we're going to be eating in detail, if you would please, this evening.
Certainly. What the dishes you're going to be eating tonight, and the concept is based on a British winter. So here at the restaurant we change each season. It's an idea me and Pete really put into place about 2 years ago, inspired by the Japanese, and that is changing soft furnishings and sounds and smells, which is obviously our take on it, and making people feel apart. So psychology plays a big part, and I think bringing that into the season really makes people feel a part of it. So yeah, you're obviously in the winter season at the moment, so you can hear the wind and you're going to hear the sound of bells, and you're going to have a little bit of magic hit the table. And the dishes are really inspired by mine and Pete's childhood when we were kids at Christmas. So you're going to have things like, starting to have cheese and pickle crackers, which is very, very typical what we had. You're going to have some amazing bread. It's made with roasted almonds and walnuts, macerated fruits and pork, served with like a chicken liver parfait butter that we make here. And then you'll move on to like a roast chicken dish, something similar to what our mum used to do with carrots. And then dessert, our Nan's sherry trifle, which is just a lot, it's more refined. It's just taking the whole concept of what she did. And even you're going to try something from J.K. Rowling, which inspired me and Pete. She created, obviously, her imagination of a butterbeer. And we took that idea and that concept and we created something based on that, because we just thought it was amazing how a writer could come up with such an amazing concept of food. So it's little things like that you're going to try tonight, and it's a real, like I said, a real journey, and sort of based on childhood. There might be some nostalgia that you yourself might have remembered, but that's what the menu's going to be like tonight for you.
Well, I'm really excited. I think that we ought to mention that you have another operation upstairs, right? And it's a state-of-the-art experimental kitchen lab, which is called the APT, the apartment.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're a 30-seated restaurant, and we're really lucky because we evolved it from 120 seats with one tiny kitchen originally that you can only fit two chefs in, and now it's 30 seats with three kitchens. So the one you can see there is a service kitchen, which has an open table that customers can sit at. Preparation kitchen at the back where all the work happens, and we've got a small team working on. And then upstairs, yeah, you're right, we have a development kitchen, which is our little laboratory, our little place where we can come up with ideas and work on and get away from this place, so we can spend a lot of time on each season coming up with the new concept or working on ideas from the year before. So it's a really cool, exciting space, which has enabled us to really push forward Casamia.
Well, let's make sure that listeners understand possibilities here. You can come here for lunch and dinner, I believe. You can reserve a private party upstairs. You can order a cooking session class and also dine. What else could you do here? It's all encompassing.
Yeah, no, the main principle, apart from the ones you said, is we serve one menu in the main restaurant downstairs, which is a tasting menu format to most people. For me and Pete, it's just a menu, a little journey. So just one menu that changes seasonally, and that's it really. We're open lunch and dinner here Tuesday to Saturday.
Well, I can't wait. It's going to be very exciting. Thanks for taking the time, John Ray, to talk to us. I'm sorry Peter didn't get, he's captured in the kitchen. He didn't get out here. But, and I'm also, I just thought I'd mention that you did not waste your graphic design training, because your presentations, everybody raves about the presentations as well.
Thank you very much. You're very kind.
A couple of remarkable young men, a remarkable restaurant in a remarkable city. If you're in the vicinity, make a detour, and I'm sure you'll have the same kind of wonderful experience that we had.
What
and
fun.
We'll be back after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Boy, I'm being overworked today. I even get to say welcome back. So anyway, if you think Bristol is a little bit out of the way, try Watergate Bay, not the one in Washington, D.C., the one in Cornwall, which is a surfing beach of all things.
Beautiful.
Just a few miles along the coast from Newquay, which is a major well-known surfing center. And here is where Jamie Oliver, yes, the famous one, put the third of his famous 15 restaurants. Now, you're going to find out more about 15 when we talk to Chef Andy Appleton, who cooked for us and then talked to us. So without more ado, here's over to Andy.
Generally, if someone says to me, this is an Italian-inspired kitchen, I cringe. I'm looking for Mediterranean food, dumbed down, and I get edgy about it. But here we are at 15 in Cornwall. It's 15 Cornwall is the name. And we're going to be talking to the chef here, Andy Appleton. And Andy, I had Italian food, Mediterranean food. I loved every single bite and drop of it. I just think you're a genius, and thank you.
You're welcome. What to know about the food?
No, first tell us, what is the concept of 15, and then specifically 15 Cornwall?
Okay, well, the main concept is the same as the London 15, is the training program. Unfortunately, they're all on, it's, you know, Christmas Eve, so they're all on holiday. We give them time off. Very much focused on the training of the apprenticeships each year. We just rolled that. And obviously, and keeping the food as true to what Italian food should be. With a little Cornish twist, obviously, because, you know, we've got some amazing produce in Cornwall, but not everything we can get. So there are some great cured meats being made in Cornwall, but again, so we have to, it's all about sourcing good ingredients, and you know, that's what my hardest job is, actually, is getting the produce down to Cornwall, and it's working closely with suppliers and always using seasonal produce. What's around, I will use it, nothing out of season, buying the best I can afford, hence the mozzarella's come straight, get a delivery once a week direct from Italy.
See, I thought you made that in-house, but I'll tell you, it's the best mozzarella I ever had.
Tried. We have tried, but we sell a lot, and our kitchen's not that big. So, and it's, you can't make mozzarella better than the Italians, so we buy the best we can.
We ought to step back a bit, and what is the concept that Jamie Oliver used to establish the 15 mini chain of restaurants? What is the program?
As in the student program, so each year we employ around 15 students a year. The criteria is they've got to be between the ages 16 and 24, unemployed, and not without any qualifications, or when not, so not qualifications, no prior history in cooking as much. So we tend to, we'll pick, so I'll tell you the whole story, then you can, so we'll interview once a year up to about 100 people. Then we take, fast track them through the first interview stage down to about 30. Ends up around 30 students that we take to college first 5 months before they even come into the kitchen.
You mean regular university?
Yes, it's Camborne College, just, you know, so it's a catering college. So it's all, so that's where they were at their first NVQ level one, which is just their basic foods, hygiene, knife skills, and a bit cooking. Then normally we would take the best out of that 30, and we would take about 15 into the kitchen, hence the name 15. That's where it originally came from, was the amount of students from the first year. We have taken more, we've taken less. Each year is a little bit different. Then we take them in the kitchen full time for a year, where they will train one on one with a chef on each section and just rotate, and still with a day release in college once a week. So then they learn their next level, which is NVQ level 2. Then hopefully by the end of the year, so we'll get jobs for them and send them off into the big wide world and start again.
So young people with probably almost no hope unless they get a chance to come into your program. They're people that society has cast aside as being unemployable for whatever reason.
Yes, some are. You know, well, a lot of them are. You know, there's, people won't give them the chance. You know, we will. You know, it's not just all kind of, I mean, some do have bad backgrounds, there's no doubt about it. You know, some just don't have the confidence. You know, we take a mix, you know, and, you know, for some reason, a lot of anger issues these days, for some, I don't know why. you know, it's quite funny. It's when they first come in and they still have that kind of angry attitude, some of them, but it's good to see them at the end of the year and how they change. Now, they don't all become chefs, but what we have learned is they've at least done a year with us, or a year and a half college, but they have the confidence a bit more. They've got some qualifications which they've never had before. So they put a routine, coming to work every day. They've never done it. So a lot more involved than just cooking. We want to try and keep them in cooking, but not for everybody chefing. It's quite tough. So we kind of try and keep them going as long as we can here, but others, you know, they'll move on. But most of them, they're employable people now. They've had a year and a half with us, so that's already.
Now, of course, Jamie Oliver is a celebrity chef and was before he hit on this idea. I've always wondered, how does it divide up? How much did he want to do a successful restaurant chain, and how much did he want to do a goodwill rehabilitation?
To ask him that, really, but you know, I know he's very passionate. He still is very passionate about the program and about 15. He has lots of other projects on the go and lots of other businesses, but 15 is his baby. He's it's something he wanted to do, and you know, he set up. And it's, we've kept it as true as we can down here. We haven't changed the food, you know, we've kept it Italian-based, simple ingredients, cook well, and keep the program running. And it's very successful. We've kept going, and we're still busy.
Of course, you in Cornwall, you have endless, really premium products. I mean, it's just mind-boggling how much stuff you have. And then you do import good quality products from other places, Italy especially. How many of these 15s are there and where are they located?
Well, it's unfortunately only three of them. Obviously London, Amsterdam and Cornwall. I think the problem is because it's a charity-run business. It's not a money-making business, as in it's not interested to anybody who doesn't want to get involved. So you kind of have to look at it. You know, Jamie Oliver's never taken any money from 15 ever. You know, everything, all the money we make here goes back into the program to pay for the next one. Which means each student can be up to £20,000-£30,000 a year to train. We get some funding, but again, current climate, a lot of it's gone. So, you know, so everything we make has to go back into the charity.
Have you ever developed some star chefs out of this program, and people went on to really spectacular careers?
Not yet. It's still early days. We've only been open 6 years, so they still need good chefs out there. It takes a good 10 years. London now have started to, you know, they've been open 10 years, so they've got a lot more shining. You know, chefs are now making it to head chef, but it took me 20 years to become a head chef, so it's still, they've got a way to go yet.
Okay, you mentioned your career. I'd like to know what your background is.
Interesting how long you got. I started off, I'm not actually officially trained chef. I mean, my biggest passion when I left school was traveling. That's what I wanted to do more than anything, so I used to just take part-time jobs. I always worked in food for some reason. I mean, my first job, when I was a greengrocer, so that was my Saturday job, and I got really interested in fresh fruit and vegetables and herbs, fresh herbs, without even realizing it. And then next door was a butcher's shop, so I used to, in my lunch break, go and say hello and make sausages with them. And then I just gradually got into, I moved up to London, which was only, I mean, I lived just outside, so I knew London quite well, but it really wasn't until I was about 30, and I've done, that's when I realized I better start a career going. So, and I'd already had quite a lot of kitchen experience by that time in bits and pieces, but I ended up working in a restaurant in Notting Hill, and that's what I really got. I was very lucky, I had a really good head chef who kind of mentored me, and look, I just learned all the basics, which I kind of had an idea, but really I started right at the bottom and just stayed at this restaurant for two and a half years, and by the time I left it, I was running their kitchen, so it's gone from strength to strength since. Quite interesting, because my style of food is, I like just simple food cooked well, not too much fuss on the plate, not into foams and purees, and so it's, my thinking is just good food, good ingredients, cooked simply so you can taste the ingredients. So working with Jamie Oliver, it made sense because it was exactly what I like to do anyway, so that's kind of how I got here.
So you mentioned about good food, and I think that our listeners really like to have a little bit of the foodborne background. And I mean, I have to admit that we did tasting, not like a formal tasting menu, but just recommendations that you had, and put together our own, and we overordered because I expected tasting portions, but we had full-size portions. I can't tell you, I loved every single dish we had. Why don't you talk a little bit about them, starting with this really spectacular signature antipasti plate.
Okay, the antipasti is obviously wherever you go in Italy, you get different versions. And a lot of places you tend to get it more like served tapas style, where you just get little plates of everything. But we just throw it on a board, and we just best of what's around each time of year. Obviously, the mozzarella's all year round, but I think we put clementines, which are up in season at the moment, in the different cured meats. The mozzarella, obviously, which is always good, and the olives, and obviously the olive oil this time of year is, you know, it's a new just new pressed season, so literally was pressed in November, so, and we've got it already, so literally weeks later we're serving their olive oil, so which makes and it's been a really good year for olive oil in Tuscany.
Okay, other Tuscan dishes is of course the ribollita, which was a little unusual because it was sort of denser than I'm used to, and I'm trying to think what were the other thing we had at the same time. I think that was it. But then we had this fabulous, you do all your pastas in-house. How about explain this Malfaldini.
The Malfaldini is it's a deli with a little wiggle on each edge. We make it here, but that's through a machine, and we do a lot of hand, we do a lot of rolling ourselves. But this side of pasta you can't make; it needs to come through and what we call a pasta extruder. So you know, we're still making it here, but it's made by a machine. But it's a good pasta for ragouts, as it catches it all into it. But you know, like all the other pastas that are on the menu today, the tortellinis and the gnocchi are all made as well. So the pheasant ragout, okay, again this time year in Cornwall, you've probably seen them on the roads, especially dead ones. There's a lot of pheasants around. So again, if I'm a local estate, one of the big shoots up, and you know, we would buy them from the local as we can. So the pheasants you ate today was just up top of the hill here.
The pheasant and the ragu sauce all together and the pasta were just absolutely incredible. There were so many choices, we didn't know what to do, which is how we ended up eating so much food. Now, I had pollock fillet yesterday. It wasn't even close to this. I mean, it was such a big, wonderful fillet. Talk to us about that and at the same time about the roast shoulder.
Start with the pollock, obviously, it's about the freshness. And I always try and get the nice large fillets as well, so you get a nice... And the pollock is quite meaty, you know, and it's very sustainable down in Cornwall. There's a lot of it. And the beauty of Cornwall, there's a lot of fish to choose from. Again, depending, you know, one thing I learned coming to Cornwall was, you know, how seasonal fish is down here. You know, being a London chef, you ordered your fish every day and it came whatever you ordered. You know, so we tend to buy fish when it's very seasonal, and a lot of it around obviously keeps the price down, and we want to use what's around at the time of year. So obviously it's a good time of year for pollock. Again, cooking it, we just, you know, just pan fried it on the skin side down and just pretty much cooked it all the way through skin side down, and literally just flip it at the last minute so it keeps it really moist. Don't and we serve that with the aubergine caponata.
Caponata was spectacular. What is in that that's so special?
A lot of things, actually. So basically, besides the aubergine, there's onions, olives, raisins, pine nuts, and it's a little sweet, because the whole caponata dish is quite interesting because it's a Sicilian dish. And of course, what's really interesting is some of the herbs and spices they use are quite unusual for Italian food, because they were closer to the north, to Africa spice route. So there's always, you find cinnamon, cocoa powder sometimes in some of the dishes, and so we tend to use a little bit of that. So it's very sweet and sour, sugar, balsamic vinegar. There's quite a lot goes into caponata, but it is we sell a lot, and it's, again, very simple dish. So it's just caponata, fish with the summery glue, which is just like an oregano and oil and lemon juice.
Be prepared, I will not leave this establishment until you give me a spelled out recipe for this particular caponata. I was raised Sicilian and we made caponata. This is so far superior to any I've ever had. I loved it. So complex. And then, of course, this wonderful pork.
Okay, yeah, it's one of my favorite dishes. So we slow roasted the pork shoulders overnight. So, you know, really low heat, been going for like a good 8-9 hours, and just until it just melts in the mouth. Again, a local supplier. He sells us one pig a week, and we break it down with the students and teach them all the cuts. And we do different things for each part of it. So, yeah, that would have got in last night, that pork, at about 11 o'clock, and just gently, and it would have taken out about 11 o'clock this morning. Cooking the heat, got the crackling up and going, and literally we serve it, we just pull it off the bone. So it's a bit similar to pulled pork, really, but then we don't do anything else with it. We don't toss anything. It literally just comes straight on the plate. And we serve that with the polenta, which is, you know, I'm a massive fan of polenta, and it's a hard one to sell to people, actually. A lot of people, I don't like polenta. Because they're used to the instant dried version, which isn't as good. So, again, that polenta would have cooked out really long and slow. About 2 hours we cooked that, the polenta out. And just right at the end, parmesan, butter, and seasoning. Kept it really simple.
Well, we didn't have room for desserts and specialty cheeses, Cornwall cheeses, for the most part, I believe. But they look good. It's just like, I think there's probably something for everybody here. Rabbit.
The sun is going down over waves, rolling in where the fetch of the wave starts somewhere in Newfoundland or Labrador, and it's coming all the way over here. Not for nothing, Newquay, just down the road, is a world-class surfing center, but here it's just beautiful, in beautiful Watergate Bay, right at the end of the road. If I jumped over the edge of this restaurant, I would land in water of a little freshwater stream coming on the back of a beach. It's just a spectacular setting, and what more can we say? Come here. If you come to call it, don't miss it. The website is 15cornwall.co.uk, and they're open 7 days a week, 3 meals a day, so you have no excuse. The only challenge you will have is to get really good directions and follow them carefully. Otherwise, you'll be like us and you'll stop and turn around 3 times.
I just wanted to mention they do now reservations for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and they have school programs, and they do so much good. They have a foundation, and on top of all this, the food is spectacular. Andy, I'm just so pleased to have met you and experienced your cooking. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And it's time to take a break, but don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Still in England on the menu is, and our third port of call, which is certainly out in the country.
Oh, it's beautiful.
With no houses in sight, only beautiful fields and gardens, and a wonderful manor house from the 17th century, I think, or maybe it was the late 16th century,
yes,
called Gravetye Manor. Curiously, just a 15-minute ride from Gatwick Airport, which is what we did. We spent lunchtime the day before we were coming home from England, and then drove the short distance to Gatwick Airport to stay overnight before coming home. But we had a wonderful afternoon eating lunch cooked by executive chef Rupert Gledow.
We want to go back.
Yeah, we want to go back.
I want to go back when the gardens are in bloom.
Yeah, we want to go back in the worst kind of way. You'll want to hunt out this establishment, I'm sure, but in the meantime, you'll get a preview in our discussion with Rupert.
We've had a very, very attractive meal in a very gorgeous place with a chef that I just met, who's also quite gorgeous. Hello, Rupert. Rupert Gledow. Okay. You have so much to deal with. We have so much to deal with this interview, because this place we're in is historic. And it's all being brought up to date anyhow. Can you give us an idea of the vintage of this, the age of this property? I know what it is, actually. I can do that. It's a 16th century property, house and gardens, and the gardens are wonderful. But where you would come in is you happen on a property that gives you all these natural, local, homegrown, farmed in your garden. An acre, I think it is, for you, plus access to, well, so many different wonderful products in the region. When did you come here? Let's start a little bit about your background, and I'll talk a little bit more later about the history of the property.
Well, okay. I've been here for 6.5 years now. I came back to England about 10 years ago, and I've worked in a couple of places local to here. But I was lucky enough to get the head chef's job here about 6.5 years ago. As soon as I got the opportunity, I realized that it really was a unique opportunity in this part of the country. We have the most fantastic kitchen garden. We have wonderful grounds here. We have more local produce, more local game, fruit, vegetables, some of our own and some local to here, that any chef could possibly hope for. We have an enormous responsibility here to make sure we make the most of it. Our garden team work incredibly hard, produce the best fruit and vegetables that Mother Nature can provide for us. And it's our responsibility to make sure we really get that to the table as uncomplicated as we can and as honestly as we can.
Now, you're not a novice chef here. You've had some really interesting experiences elsewhere. When you end up, though, here you are, what do you think are the things that interest you most, besides the fact you have so many wonderful natural ingredients that fit? What kinds of food do you really like to cook?
Well, I've been lucky enough to travel quite extensively in my life. I grew up in the north of Scotland. Since then, I left in my teens. But I have lived and worked in the UK. I've lived and worked in Australia, in New Zealand, in France for a little while, in the Channel Islands. And I think the opportunity I have here is to take some of the best produce that I've ever seen and use some of the techniques and experiences that I've gleaned over the years and put them together in a particular style. I think Gravetye has a style now unlike any other. I think we're very lucky here to have a team that can produce a dining experience that can't be copied anywhere else. Our experiences have given us the opportunity to marry flavours and to marry ideas into new and exciting dishes, which I hope you saw today.
You know, we actually did not introduce where we are, which is Gravetye Manor, which I think we should put that right up front. Can you sort of tell us a little bit about where we are exactly?
Yeah, we're in the south of England. We're about 15 minutes from Gatwick Airport. We're about half an hour from Brighton and the coast, and we're 45 minutes from London on the train. We're perfectly situated in the countryside, can't see any other house, any built-up areas from the hotel. You can be in Gatwick in 15 minutes.
And it's a Relais-Château property, so ongoing, not just restoration of this property, which is so historical and gorgeous, but it's also, as I understand it, you're intent upon reassociating this with evolving with the new standards of contemporary cuisine, hospitality, etc. Is that true?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we're the second oldest country house hotel in the country, so we have a heritage to maintain, and we have a responsibility to those that have gone before us to maintain the standards. But we're also at a very exciting time where we can provide a more modern and possibly a more contemporary dining experience and stay here than we've ever had before. It's an opportunity for us to build on the history of the hotel and hopefully carve a new history out for us.
One of the things that impressed us the most about this meal, and the menu itself is exciting. There are things that you're very familiar with occasional twists, but you execute so perfectly. My husband was so incredibly impressed with the venison done to a T, which is difficult to do. Could you run us through some of the other dishes that we had, starting with, I don't know why I ordered this. They said it was made of butter poached native lobster.
Yeah, we served you today. We served the native lobster for you, which is served with Ossietra caviar and a light ginger beurre blanc. And we set that on some braised baby gem lettuce. Like a lot of the dishes we have here, we use a very fine ingredient and we try and treat it with the utmost respect. We don't do anything to the lobster other than poach it in butter, give it a touch of lemon, a touch of seasoning, put it on some baby gem that was just wilted, even just warm. Use some very fine caviar, hugely decadent butter sauce, and we leave it at that. There's some fantastic flavors. They marry well together, and they need very little input from us, really. It's more about timing. It goes for a lot of the dishes that we have on the menu. I believe you had the scallops as well. Scallops always from the Hebrides. I was brought up in Scotland. I firmly believe Scottish scallops are as good as they get. And we served that with some caramelized cauliflower, a little bit of pickled chicory, a few roasted shallots, and a burn rosette crumb. We keep it simple. We keep it fresh. I think the scallops are a fantastic product before we get our hands on them. I think it's important we don't do too much to them. When you talk about the venison, it's very much the same story. Can't drive to Gravetye without seeing the deer in the fields. And that's where our venison comes from. We buy it from a trusted supplier of a known farm in the area. And we pair it with vegetables that come out of our own garden. We use a sauce made from sloes that we have growing on the property. We braise red cabbage that grown ourselves, and we confit some violet potatoes that come from a local supplier. The flavors work well together, they marry well together, and I think it produces a wonderful dish. Part you had, same deal. We paired it with Brussels sprouts and chestnuts and some wild mushrooms from Ashdown Forest, which is 10 miles away. Serve it with its own roasting juices. We take it off the bone for you. Other than that, we leave it as God intended.
Rupert, you're really spoiled with all this great produce, but I think you're overly modest in terms of how well you produce stuff because you're so meticulous about your execution. I don't know where that came from, but you really are meticulous about execution.
I'm old enough to have grown up with some fairly aggressive, very, very passionate chefs, and I have had it beaten into me from a very young age that things have to be done right. There's no point in doing this job if you don't have a passion for it, and there's no point in doing anything if you're going to do it badly. We make every effort to make sure that everything we produce is as good as the last dish and the first dish and every other dish we produce. Attention to detail is, I hope, what separates us from a lot of other establishments, not necessarily in the area, but in the country. We strive to be better, and we do that by the attention to detail.
Now, we mentioned earlier in the interview that property is truly 15 minutes from Gatwick Airport. First of all, question, what kind of people come here? Where do they come from? How long do they stay?
Well, I think we appeal certainly to the American market. We have a lot of Americans who come here to enjoy the gardens, to enjoy the atmosphere here, the history of the building, the sense of relaxation you get here, the sense of space, rare for the south of England. We're a busy country, but here you can pass days without having to talk to anyone or hear anything. The aeroplanes don't come over us, so we're close enough to Gatwick, but you never know it. And the Europeans who want to come and have a touch of history, come and see some of British heritage, some come and see one of the oldest country houses, walk in the gardens, walk through the kitchen garden, see the produce they're going to eat in the evening, come and have a relaxing dinner in a fairly informal environment. We don't stand on ceremony. We're not too pompous here. We believe that people should come and relax and enjoy themselves.
Yeah, I can echo that. We didn't see any ties. Not surprisingly, on the menu, listeners, you will know that Peter doesn't wear one very often, even though you really rarely see him. But I didn't see any ties in the dining room either. So I suppose you can, but you certainly don't have to. Yeah, the website is
gravetymanor.co.uk, which is www.gravetymanor.co.
Now, I had something I wanted to say, is that there are a number of aspects of this place that are in transition, including you're redoing your whole wine program, which is good as it is now. But you're aiming for something a lot better.
Yeah, I think it's important that the style of the menu is reflected in the style of the wine menu. We have had as many as 200 odd bins on the wine menu. I think we're simplifying that slightly. We're making it more accessible. Our restaurant manager has a real passion for wine and a real talent for wine, both pairing the wines with the food and wines in their own right. I think we're going to see our wine list become more and more accessible and more unique in the coming months. And I think there's no question we're going to have one of the best and nicest wine lists that any country house can lay claim to.
We have decided we have to come back here to stay over and tour the garden when it's in season. Do you have any thoughts on the appropriate time to come? And we're planning next to come in the spring, the late spring, as a possibility. Do you have any ideas about when the best times of the year would be to come?
I'm not a great gardener. I can honestly say that Tom, our head gardener, has the most amazing talent for picking any time of the year, the perfect time to see our gardens. The spring is fantastic. It is all the new flowers, and it is wonderful and colourful, and it's a sight to behold. But I've been amazed by the quality and beauty of the garden at every time of the year. I don't know how he does it, but I think it's a great deal of hard work and a dedicated team. But there's no bad time to come and see the garden.
That's pretty much a wrap-up. Rupert Gledow. I'm so bad. I thank you so much for this wonderful meal, and also for taking the time to talk to on the menu, listeners. I hope to see you again.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here, and I look forward to seeing you again. Come and actually stay and see the gardens.
And we'll be back with a final segment on a very important and controversial subject right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and welcome back to some serious business. Sometimes On the Menu is a very light-hearted program. Sometimes we bring you interesting people. Sometimes we bring you interesting people who have really serious things that they want to bring to your attention. And Oceana falls into that category, an organization dedicated to trying to make sure that mankind on this earth does a better job of appropriately managing its oceans for the sustainability of the fishing catch that comes from them. A very important subject worldwide, and one I'm sure that you'll want to know more about. So here's Beth, who's going to give us the story.
Lowell,
there you go. Well, what do I know? This is why I need you to be in charge. So here's Beth.
Beth Lowell, what is the origin of Oceana, which is your organization?
We're an international ocean conservation organization that was formed about 11 years ago.
Okay.
And we are in the U.S. as well as in Europe, Central and South America, And we were formed to be in a conservation organization that's focused 100% on the oceans every day, all the time. So we're the largest international ocean conservation that dedicates all of its time to protecting the world's oceans.
Now, who founded it?
We were founded by a number of foundations that came together. They were looking at some of the other national NGOs in the U.S. and looking at the amount of resources that they put towards ocean conservation, and then decided that what we really needed was a global conservation organization that would be dedicated to protecting the oceans all the time. So they formed Oceana initially, the initial pool of funders, but since then we've grown to be supported by other foundations and major donors and individuals as well.
Now, your mission is total conservation, this sort of a guardianship of the of our waters, but you have certain issues that kind of float to the top, if you will. Recently, you did some major studies about seafood fraud, and through that, you got a lot of support from, I think that it was 500 chefs joined the organization for this mission.
Yeah, so we as an ocean conservation organization started looking into seafood fraud about a year and a half ago. We saw some academic studies and saw some newspaper stories about seafood mislabeling. And we were concerned about mislabeled seafood for a number of reasons. One, you can launder illegally caught fish into the U.S. market.
Uh-huh.
So it allows profits from illegal seafood. Also, for some of the conservation impacts, sometimes if you see, for example, red snapper, which is a fishery that has been depleted in the past, everywhere on every menu, it's really hard for the average consumer to think why a fishery needs strict fishing limits on them if red snapper's everywhere. Well, come to find out, many times when you order red snapper, you're actually getting some different fish. And then also it's just a consumer issue that people are being ripped off. So we decided to start looking into this about in May 2011, and we have gotten tremendous support. What we've done initially to talk about the issue of seafood fraud is to test some seafood, and we just did recently release a report in New York City where we found 39% of the seafood to be mislabeled in New York.
That's a really high rate, isn't it?
It's extremely high, yes. And because of this alarming level of fraud, we've been able to identify and work with interesting partners such as chefs and restaurant owners.
Now, two things, Beth. First of all, I guess what's happening with mislabeling is people are always going up the scale of cost, right? So you're getting a cheaper fish, which is being sold to you for the price of a more expensive fish.
Exactly. That's often the case, where you'll have a lower-cost fish, like a farm-raised tilapia, substituted for a high wild-caught, high-priced red snapper, where the difference would be dollars and dollars per pound, so people are getting ripped off. Another issue that's concerned to us is if you are trying to avoid certain types of seafood, whether you have a seafood allergy or you're a woman who's pregnant or of childbearing age is trying to limit their mercury consumption, when some of these fish are swapped out, you might be getting something that you're not intending to eat.
I got it. Now, tell us a little bit about the science behind this, or the biology, or whatever you call it. You can actually take a sample of fish and test it and know what it is?
Yeah, actually, we have worked with a few labs across the U.S. where we were able to send out Oceana staff and supporters with little vials, and they put a sample of their dinner in these vials.
Oh, wow.
Recorded down all the information of the fish, and we sent academic labs and had them actually extract the DNA and tell us what species of fish it was. So we've tested seafood so far in Boston, in L.A., in Miami, and New York City, and so we've had great success with this testing regime that we've developed. And we were actually surprised that you were able to take a piece of fish that's been cooked and sauced and taken home in somebody's to-go container and still be able to extract the DNA to identify what type of fish it was, but it worked.
Okay, so it's back. It's basic biological DNA each particular fish has a particular DNA print, if you like.
Exactly, it has its own fingerprint. Because I think it's over 1,700 species of commercially available fish in the U.S. The average consumer or chef for that matter, is if you just look at a fillet, it's really hard to tell. So we've been using DNA to identify the species of fish. And that's one of the where the real problem comes down is seafood supply chain is pretty complex and diverse. It goes from the boat to processing and the head and the skin's ripped off and then fillets and more cooking and saucing and everything. So what you finally end up getting on your plate is far different from what actually got off the boat.
Now, here's an interesting question. So you found out this is going on. 39% of the time, in the case of one particular species of fish in one particular city. Now, who's responsible for enforcing this? Suppose you actually find that out, and you now know that it's being marketed, people are being ripped off. Who enforces this? Is there any law behind it?
Well, on the local level, it would be State Department of Health are supposed to be enforcing some of the food labeling laws. But overall, it's the Food and Drug Administration and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Okay. The federal agencies are responsible for, one, keeping illegal fish from getting into the supply chain, and then, two, tracking our fish. It is illegal to mislabel in, fish in the U.S. So it's just a matter of enforcement. But because we have so much seafood going in and out of this country and all around and in circles, we the only way to stop this high level of mislabeling, 39% is certainly not a clerical error, is to have traceability of the seafood supply chain. So you actually, information follows a fish from the time it's landed at the dock through the supply chain to the final purchaser. So not only can consumers have more confidence with the food that they're eating, or the seafood that they're buying, but also government can come in throughout the supply chain and verify identity of the seafood supply.
Now, when's that going to happen? That sounds like quite a large bite.
It is a large bite. That's what Oceana's goal is on our seafood fraud work, is to get traceability of seafood sold in the U.S. There are already regional programs that do have traceability. For example, there's in the Gulf of Mexico, there's Gulf Wild and Gulf Seafood Trace, which are traceability programs for Gulf seafood. There's some on the East Coast, whether it's Rhode Island Trace and Trust. And programs like this show that traceability already is being used. It helps fishermen sell their fish for a higher cost because they can actually tell a story of where their fish was caught. And for those who are trying to eat locally sourced seafood. So it definitely works, and it's happening. And these voluntary programs are great. The problem is the bad actors are not going to be the ones that are tracing their seafood and being transparent with the supply, which is why we need to have traceability for the whole seafood supply chain.
Now, we hear that seafood moves pretty quickly these days. And in fact, a lot of the seafood catch is sold via communication from the boat when it just caught it back to people who are buying it, and particularly with fine quality fish, rare quality fish, the restaurateurs and high-end suppliers. Does this just make it harder to implement your kind of program?
No, absolutely no, not at all. That's exactly the type of information that should be going from with the fish to the end purchaser, is the vessel, where it was caught, when it was caught, the species identification information should go with that. And when restaurants are able to have that relationship with a seafood supplier, you're less likely to get mislabeled fish. It's often when you don't know where your seafood's coming from is where you have more chances for mislabeling.
One of the hot new fishes is branzino. In U.S. restaurants, that's something that's hot, where it's been traditional in Italy and other parts of Europe. Does that cut down on this fraud if you actually have the whole fish?
Absolutely. There's a lot less of a chance for mislabeling when you actually have the whole fish. So chefs can look at their fish and know when they open the box that they did get the right fish on the label, as well as for consumers if they know what the fish looks like. Definitely whole fish can reduce the level of mislabeling. Obviously, the more processing and the more steps it takes for that fish to get to your plate or your grocery store bag, the more chances there are for some shady practices and
so more of the evidence kind of disappears when the head's gone and the tails are
exactly.
gone and the fins are gone. You need the DNA in order to be able to solve it.
We actually did a tasting a taste test, if you will, where we took red snapper, or we took a snapper species in tilapia, and we had a chef prepare them exactly the same, cut them into exactly the same pieces, test guess whether they could figure out which one was the tilapia and which one was the snapper. And almost the whole room, it was, you know, 50-50, no idea which one. They taste, if once prepared, it was almost exactly the same, which made it show that even with people with chefs in a room and scientists, they still were fooled by a bait and switch of seafood.
Now, here's just a final question before we go. This is deception. You're talking about deception by the supplier of the fish, but you just said that in this taste test in a restaurant, 50% of the time people couldn't tell what it was. Do you think there's deception going on in restaurant kitchens as well?
Well, from our testing, where we found 39% of the seafood we tested in New York was mislabeled, 48% in Boston, almost 50% in L.A., where what we test is the final point of purchase. So we can't get into the supply chain because we're just a customer purchasing fish from a grocery store or a restaurant. So we don't know where the mislabeling happened. It okay. could happen at the restaurant itself. It could happen at a processor, at a distributor, anywhere in the supply chain. So that's one of the reasons why it's really critical to have this information flow from the dock to to your final dinner plate, so you actually can track the fish and less shenanigans can happen anywhere in the supply chain.
Well, Beth, you just have an absolutely gargantuan task ahead of you.
And then
you have whole countries like Japan that won't even, as your organization, the one that did the Paris conference where the Japanese wouldn't even show up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how you're going to do it, but I sure hope you do.
Well, thank you.
And we hope that the opportunity to talk to us and send this out to our listenership will be a part of the process of helping you to get the things in place that you need to get. So thank you so much, Beth, for joining us, and thank you for being on top of this most important issue.
Thank you all.
So that's all for this week's program. We hope that you'll join us again next week, same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.
And I'll say bye-bye, and we'll all hope that Miss Anne's in better voice by the time the clock rolls around another 7 days. And again, in parting, a happy new year to all of you, prosperity to you and yours,
and of course,
health too, and of course, we're hoping the same for ourselves. So until next week again, bye-bye for now.